everyone. I'm Katie Couric, and this is Next Question. What's your Alan Cumming touchstone? Did you first fall for the waifish Scott and Romeo Michelle's high school reunion?
Since this is the last night of school and all, would you care to dance with me once?
No.
Or was it his romantic hijinks in Emma that hooked you?
Who can think of Miss Smith when Miss Woodhouse is near?
Maybe you're more of a GoldenEye Bond Boy fan.
I am invincible!
Spy Kids?
Yet the cunning and intelligence of the world's greatest espionage agents all rolled into tiny packages I call Spy Kids!
The Good Wife?
Can I say son of a bitch, or is that too salty?
Oh, it's gotta be Cabaret.
Welcome, bienvenue. Welcome.
There are almost too many to count.
I'm sure there are.
Alan Cumming is a Renaissance man of his own making. From theater to TV and film, he's a chameleon who melts into every role he takes on. But he doesn't stop there. He owns a club in New York, Club Cumming. I went there once. He also started his own perfume line, Cumming the Fragrance. He's an outspoken advocate for LGBTQ rights. He's also the author of a book of fiction, one memoir, and now a second memoir called Baggage.
I just constantly talk about myself from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to bed.
Alan and I spoke right before his book came out. And no offense to everyone else I've interviewed, but he's just about the most charming human on the planet who really knows how to tell a good story.
I did have another tattoo. That was on my body, but I had it removed by laser that had a young gentleman's name on it. Yeah, I've had that. I've done that, Katie. Never done that? Never got met someone and 2 weeks later had their name tattooed on your body? Oh, you haven't? Oh, I thought everyone did that.
No, were you intoxicated at the time?
In a way, because when I write about this in the book, I call him Adonis, and I was... It's just this man I had a short-lived relationship with. I feel like I was the victim of a chemical attack. Do you know, like, that sort of chemistry that you have with someone and the sort of, you know, the endorphins or whatever is released and you find yourself doing things, you're completely out of control with desire or lust or whatever it is. And after 2 weeks of knowing each other, we decided we'd get our names tattooed on each other's groins. And I thought that was the most sensible thing I'd ever done. I really did. I thought it was completely sensible. And then 4 months after that, we split up and I was left with the name Raven on my groin. And I got, what's hilarious is I got it. I was in LA making a film and there was a special, tattoo removal place at Cedar Sinai Hospital. So I went and you have to go several times. It's really sore. They laser it off. And you can hear this, and it's the sound of the ink exploding in your body.
Is it more painful getting it removed than to actually get a tattoo?
Yeah, because then also you've got to keep going back. You know, it's not just once you do it; it's several times, and it is more painful. And then also because it goes all scabby and yucky, and that sore as well. And so, but the thing was, when I eventually saw him afterwards, so about a year afterwards, he said, "Do you still have your tattoo?" I said, "No, I had mine wrenched from my body by laser." And he said, "I said, do you still have yours?" He said, "Kinda." And he pulled down his pants, and where it used to say Alan, it now says Balance.
That's very clever.
Yes, isn't that good?
I was going to say, what could you have done with his name?
A ravenous, craven. I could have taken a wee bit of the N off and been Raver. All my friends were delighted in telling me the things that I could do. You know, it was, yes. Done. Oh, my friend David wanted to put Dun Raven. That's what he was, like D-U-N at the beginning. But I was like, all right, I feel foolish enough. You don't need to rub it in.
But instead you got it removed. Well, yeah. Let's talk about your memoir because it's so exciting. And I know you're tired of talking about it, but I don't know. Let's give it the old college try. So it's called Baggage. And I feel like, Alan, you've spent a lot of time in your adult life unloading yours because this is your second memoir, of course.
Yes.
And the first was really powerful about your dysfunctional relationship with your father,
yes.
who was terrible. And I thought it was incredible that it had such an impact. And you heard from so many people who were able to deal with or metabolize their own dysfunctional relationships with the parent.
Yes.
So that was really the focal point of your first memoir. And you wanted to do another one because?
Well, mostly because, well, a couple of reasons, of course, but mostly because I as a reaction to the reaction to my first one. Because I think the first one, it was, you know, I had this very violent and abusive father, and I felt the way that it was. I mean, look, I was so excited ultimately by the way that it helped so many people, and people keep writing me saying I'd be able to talk to my abuser, or I talk, you know, all that stuff you just mentioned. But also there was a rhetoric which sort of said, Alan has triumphed, Alan has overcome, Alan has, Alan has conquered this terrible dark past. And I feel like that's a very American thing to sort of try and tie up things and make it all like, it's done now, we're done this. Instead of just thinking, I have, you know, I am happy and I have a life that I, but I've not overcome it. It's still a part of me. It's always going to be a part of me. I think we're all like that. Oh, we all have baggage or trauma or shit in our lives. And we don't, the moment you ignore it and say, oh, I don't, and deny it, then it's just going to fester and come back to bite you in the bum. And actually, it's, you just have to be open about it and honest. And, you know, like in the pandemic, I think it's been really interesting how we've all understood the value of discussing our mental health and checking in on each other's mental health. And it's something we haven't done as a culture before. And so actually, I think that's all that I'm asking people to do, is to not think of me as someone who has absolutely triumphed over something and killed it. I'm actually living with something and I've managed it. I've managed to make my life. And I think I just want to normalize the trauma and damage that we've all got, we all carry it, and not to, let's just not pretend that we can get over something. You just get better at dealing with it.
How do you think, I mean, obviously there's a multitude of ways, but when you think about how your abusive father, how that relationship continues to manifest itself and the demons that you have to continue to fight?
Well, I get very triggered by angry men. I used to try and fix people who were angry. I used to have an obsession with trying to fix. I had several relationships where I was just basically trying to fix angry people. I thought it was my fault. I thought there must be something I've done. I thought there was something I could do to stop them being angry. I was seeking the familiar. And I think that I've got over that, thank goodness. But I do get very triggered by angry men. And I just, you know, it's something that I just got to be vigilant about. Some people, you know, people have a right to be angry, and they're a bit sort of out of control, irrational anger, I find difficult. And people, I find it when people are sort of trying to bring me down, I feel quite confident about myself. But when I'm aware that people are sometimes, you know, I'm sure you know this, if when you're well known and sort of seen as being accomplished, sometimes you go into scenarios and environments where people want to bring you down a peg or two, and it's sort of just their way of making themselves feel better about themselves. And I find that's very triggering for me, because I want to allow them to do that, and but also I know it's not fair, and I want to, so I really try hard to let people do their shit, but not me, not be affected by it, not to make me sort of bring them down with me. So that, things like that. And then also, you know, another thing that I feel, I talk about a bit is the fact that I've never had children. I feel that I did have a spell when I, you know, I start the book by talking about trying to have a child with my ex-wife, and how, in a way, how grateful I am that that wasn't possible. Or didn't happen, because we split up and everything, and me thinking about being a father is what precipitated me remembering a whole lot of stuff from my childhood that I had repressed, and then having a nervous breakdown. And so now I did think about having kids with a couple of people, other partners, and, you know, and some people, you know, wanted my sperm and all that stuff. I was going to do that with an ex and all that stuff, but now I'm 56, I'm not going to have kids. And I don't want to, but in the writing of this book and thinking about it and talking about myself endlessly, I sort of think, well, I write this thing, I say, you know, I have lots of young friends, people who are, could be my children. And I have friends of all ages, but I actually love having young friends. I think it's really great to sort of find, you know, to keep in touch with what's happening. And like my assistant's 26. I think it's great to sort of think, what's your life like now? And, you know, and it is like having, you know, obviously it's a big grown up, but I am old enough to be his dad and stuff like that. And so in a way I have become the father I wish I'd had, but it's no accident that he is childless.
Are you sorry, Alan, that Wistful...
I don't have kids.
Yeah.
I'm not sorry. I really love my life. I don't want... Oh, God, the idea of having a kid now would be a nightmare.
No, but that you didn't ever.
I think I wonder if part of the reason... Or not part of... I wonder if the reason... I wonder if the reason I didn't was that I was scared I would become my father. And so, you know, that's how far his reach still comes. And I don't like that. I don't like the fact that I have avoided something in my life that... And I didn't avoid it. I tried to... It just didn't happen. But I ultimately stayed away from it because I have... It's triggering for me and it's weird. And you know, if when I was 28 and I was trying to get pregnant with my wife, that's what precipitated me having a huge... My mind... completely brought all these images back. And, you know, it did that for a reason. It did that to, because I had never been able to deal with them before. I was too little and too young to process what was happening to me. So it waited until I was going to go into that same sort of arena again, father, the patriarchy, I suppose. And I feel that if my mind is as powerful to do that, and then to, you know, make me have all those images and all those feelings and then to kind of break down, then I think it is as equally as powerful to perhaps persuade me not to do something just in case I wasn't fully, you know, it's that transference of the intergenerational transference of trauma is a thing, you know, it's a powerful thing. Your DNA can be changed. It's been tested. Your DNA can be changed by the trauma that your parents have endured.
Do you feel like, and then I want to talk about this new memoir, but do you feel, having written about your dad in the first one, that you understand, maybe you don't forgive him, but that you understand what were the forces that shaped him to be the monster he sounds like he was?
I mean, I sort of. I think actually I do forgive him. And I'm not sure I do understand all this. I mean, there's some. I'm not sure, and I'll never be sure. I'll never be able to be sure. I think he had many personality disorders. I think he was mentally ill, absolutely. I think he was abused by his father, yes. And he didn't break that cycle. And of course, that's also what terrified me, that I would not be able to stop that too. I mean, I feel I've pretty much done everything you should do or can do to break a cycle, like talking about it, doing therapy, da, da, da. But who knows? But in terms of the actual other stuff, the kind of, you know, I've talked to doctors and therapists, and I think I have got a handle on some of the sort of, as I say, personality disorders that he had. But who knows? I don't know. He wasn't an evil person. He was just a very damaged and scared person. And actually, you know, as much as he was this big macho guy, and he was very charismatic and very sexy and all that stuff as well, but he was very, I think he was scared, and I think he was a coward. And I think that's, I'm not a coward, and I feel I stood up to him, and I you know, did things that he would never do in terms of facing demons and facing stuff. So I did, like, I was just talking earlier, actually, that, you know, when you read the audiobook of your book, it's kind of funny because you sometimes are reading aloud things you've only ever written down. And like the acknowledgements bits, you just do that at the end, and you don't sort of, and in the acknowledgements to my last memoir, Not My Father's Son, I said in the acknowledgements that I forgave my father, but I didn't, ever read that aloud until I was in the studio recording the audiobook, and I just lost it, you know, completely was weeping. So I do forgive him because I think I don't want to carry around this shit. You know, I forgive him for me. You know, I forgive you. You did it. It happened. I'm moving on. I'm not going to. I feel like not forgiving means you're keeping the trauma with you. So I feel it's mine to give away, forgiveness. So I did.
Talk about how this memoir, because it is a really interesting mix. You have hilarious anecdotes,
yes,
about everyone from Faye Dunaway, Liza Minnelli, Gore Vidal, and yet it also interweaves sort of more serious topics. How did you approach this memoir when you thought, I'm going to write a second memoir and this is my goal, this is what I want to do?
Well, it took me a long time because I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do actually when I started it. I thought it was maybe going to be about me coming to America and having this new life at age 30, you know, because I hadn't been to America at all until I was 30. And so I had a whole other perspective. But I think I sort of, over the years that it took, I think it takes you a while, unless you're writing a story and the story has an ending and you know what, and you plot it out, you know, in a fiction. My story's not ended. And so I had to find out what the plot was, and I've done it, you know, between two marriages, between my end of my first marriage and the beginning of my second. And I wanted to sort of say, I mean, basically I wanted to say that thing about, don't think I'm all finished and complete and conquered. Here's me being a bit of a hot mess a lot of the time in my life, having a great time, having a laugh, having, you know, doing all that, but concurrently with all that, also suffering and being a bit of making some bad decisions. And I think that's what I want to kind of normalize being a hot mess, you know. I think it's entirely possible to have a great successful life and also have moments when you're just a hot mess. So that's my ambition, is to normalize hot messness.
We'll be right back. I know that you didn't really talk at all about your sexuality. And I know, you know, and that was quite intentional, it seems to me. Even you have reached queer icon status. you don't really talk about dealing with. I should rephrase that. You don't talk about dealing with coming out or you know, I know that you talk about the fluidity of partnerships. You talk about flings with men and women. And I know that you feel that whole conversation really needs to be reframed in the culture.
I think I really do. I mean, I left all that out on purpose. I even felt in my last memoir, you know, they wanted me to do a sort of, when did you know, all that sort of stuff. And I said, and also about, you know, a thing about Grant, my husband, and stuff like that. And I said, you wouldn't ask me to do this if I was straight. You wouldn't say, when did I know I was straight? You know, nobody gets asked that. And you wouldn't ask someone who's writing a memoir to talk about your partner in the way that you're wanting me to do that. And it didn't feel organic or authentic to me. So I said no. And I feel like with this, I talk about, yes, I'm with a woman and now I'm with a man. But because that's just how it was. And then I was back with a woman. You know, I just talk about my life as it was. I just feel I'm so bored. I mean, I said this the other day, like straight people don't know how lucky they are not to be constantly probed about their sexuality. And you don't ever get asked about, you know, do you find it a problem being straight? Or when did you know you were straight? And, you know, has your straightness do you think being straight in Hollywood is all that? That would be so funny.
That would be a good SNL skit.
It would, wouldn't it? Yes. And so that to me is really boring. And also I think, you know, what I think is really interesting about the time we live in right now, this sort of time of non-binariness and fluidity, and the notion that I think is coming into our culture much more, that you don't have to be one or the other. You can go back and forward between gender and sexuality and everything. That's kind of something I've always sort of felt. I've always felt that I would always define myself as bisexual. If people call me gay, I don't mind. queer. I like queer actually. I think it's a good thing because it sort of is an umbrella that's not just about sex, you know, it's much more sort of about sensibility as well. But also I think I think that I have this thing I say, it's kind of a joke, but I think it's true, is that, you know, sexuality to me is like, it's grey, it's not black and white. It's sexuality is like a vacation. You don't always want to go to the same place twice. And I think that's something that people are more able to understand now. And I don't, you know, what am I supposed to say? Like, oh, well, at school, I, you know, I had sex with this boy and then I had sex with this girl. I mean, I don't, that's not what my book's about. It's not what I want to talk about. I don't feel that I feel I have talked so much about my sexuality and been so open about it. That's my, what I have to say. That's what I have to, I'm open and I have no shame about sexuality. I think that's the biggest thing I can give to society. I'm not interested in, you know, when did you know and what effects has that, all that stuff.
I do think it's so interesting, Alan, how you can look back on the last 40 years. You know, when I wrote my book, I was talking about sort of some of the cluelessness I had early on in my career. I remember interviewing Matthew Shepard's parents, Judy and Dennis, who I became very friendly with.
They're darlings, aren't they?
And they're so nice. And I know they've honored you at their foundation. And, you know, I remember I write in my book about asking the Shepherds if they were disappointed when Matthew told them they were gay, he was gay, and were they disappointed that they weren't, you know, possibly going to have any grandchildren? Or I think Dennis volunteered that. It sounds so dated now.
It does, doesn't
it? And so
interesting.
So just like, what?
But I suppose that's the thing that we've changed, our culture has changed about sort of, I mean, it's actually, although it's so precarious and I feel so scared about America, actually, and about how there was so much awful stuff bubbling under the surface, you know, that we saw during the time of Trump and could easily come back again and could be more, you know, I don't take my rights and my life in this country for granted. I think I could easily be persecuted if things went slightly the other way. But I think with so much actually has changed and since, you know, and then of course Matthew Shepard was a huge turning point, I think. And that was actually right when I first came to New York, 1998, that's when I was doing Cabaret, I remember it. And, but I think those things, it's like, you know, stuff, pre-Me Too stuff.
Right.
It sounds now so like, how insane could we have put up with all that? But actually what you're talking about when you said that to him, that is very much how people thought in those days. It is dated, but it's not offensive, or it wasn't offensive or meant from any place of offense. It's just really interesting how things in certain areas sometimes change so fast.
It's emblematic, I think, when you look back. You know, I'm 8 years older than you are. And, you know, when I was growing up, we sort of vaguely probably knew a gym teacher was gay or somebody was gay. My French teacher, Mr. Holt, who I loved, was gay. I suspected, but it was just so not spoken about.
No.
Or maybe a wink, wink here and there. And then I fast forward it to 2015 when I interviewed Jim Obergefell, who was the plaintiff in the same-sex marriage case in the Supreme Court. And, you know, that was only 6 years ago.
I know.
And that almost feels like a lifetime ago. So to me, I think all these issues that you talk about are the things that I wanted to talk about, and the really seismic shift we've seen in the culture.
It is.
You know, yes, it's precarious, I agree, but thank God, right?
Yeah, oh my God,
Thank God.
Totally.
That we're having these reckonings.
And thank God that we have got a generation of young people who are coming up who don't think in the same way that we are, who weren't brought up in the same way that we are, who have grown up with the possibility of otherness all around them. An example, because of the internet, like they see so many different things. They have people in their classes who are transitioning or have two dads or two moms. You know, it's just, we live in a world that has changed so much. And for young people, they've always grown up with the internet. And I think that's completely changed people. If you've never not known the internet, not known that you have access to anything in the world at a couple of clicks, that is a that completely changes, must change hugely how you see the world. I mean, also, I think it certainly gives you different concentration skills, but it also puts you in a way that into a thing of, you've had so many options. You've had so much, obviously there's room for misinformation there, but I'm so kind of heartened by the young right now.
I agree. And I agree with you. It's a double-edged sword because for everything it's exposed and normalized, it's also created a platform for the kinds of things we don't want. But, you know, I was thinking as we talk about the arc of history, Cabaret was a huge moment, not only for you personally. You know, you won the whole Broadway production, won a slew of awards. People were obsessed with the show and with you. And you have an interesting analysis about why and why that show was so embraced, which I think is a little bit about what we're talking about.
Yes, it is. It's because, in writing this book, that time for me was so incredible. Coming to New York, my first job in New York, I'm starring in a Broadway musical. It becomes a sensation. I win all these awards. I'm just feted everywhere. I was overwhelmed by this wave of love. The city kind of opens its arms to me. I have no kind of touchstone. I have nothing to compare it to. It's very difficult. And it was a lot happening. And I was 33, and I was suddenly becoming a sort of, sexually objectified in a way that I'd never been before. My body was discussed in a way that was fascinating to me, but also really weird. And it was out of nowhere. But what I, when I was writing this book, and also because I'm actually very close friends with Monica Lewinsky, and I remember being in rehearsals for Cabaret in my little flat in the West Village, and turning on the TV, and all these rumblings about something big happening in Washington, and that the president was having an affair. And I remember just thinking, what the hell's wrong with these people? Why was this such big news, and what's going on? And, so over that time when I was doing Cabaret and becoming this sort of saucy, sexy, sensational thing, the kind of real life of America was about looking at this forbidden relationship to an older man and younger woman, and getting gratuitous details of their sex and being putting shame and scorn on it. And, we all know that Monica had the first person in the world to be sort of shamed by the internet on a global scale. And I just think it's really interesting that in that year she had all that. A young woman, was so shamed about her sexuality. And me, in this role being like almost like a sexual deviant was how I was described, being absolutely lauded and praised, and just everyone thought I was just great. And I think in a funny sort of way, it's because we were escapism. It was all this shame and stuff heaped onto sexuality, and people having to sort of tell their kids what a blowjob was and all this stuff, people being furious about that. And then actually here in another way is, we can pretend it's all not happening and look at this young, skinny European boy plastered across buses and being all naughty. I do think there was a connection, but that's why in a way the production was so successful at that time.
I'm fascinated by your friendship with Monica. I know her dad, Bernie.
Oh, do you?
Who's a radiologist. Yeah, because during that whole thing, we needed to get to know some of the people who were involved in that story. I wasn't super enmeshed in it because this was right around the time my husband died, and I was sort of just holding on for dear life. But it's so interesting to me, so important, and still so challenging for people to reconceive, if that even is a word, what Monica Lewinsky was and how she was treated in the culture. And I was just reading an article in Slate about how Maureen Dowd, who, I'm friendly with, but
she
how she
vile to her.
Vile, yeah. Vile and brutal, and
whole culture we're having, was, yeah.
Yeah. And we're really, I think, coming to terms, or many people are coming to terms with how she was vilified and portrayed, and you know how feminists turned their backs on her.
Yes.
And I'm curious. I would love to know if you feel like it's not betraying any confidence. Sort of how you got to know Monica and what you've learned from her and what your impressions are, because I know you're very good friends.
We're very good friends. Yeah, I love her. We met at a party in 2000. I'd written an article for Marie Claire magazine, and Glenda Bailey was the editor then, and she had a party for me, and she invited Monica because Monica had done something about Monica in the previous issue or something. So that's how we met. And we went to this dinner afterwards, and I have a picture of that night, actually, of us meeting, you know, because there was paparazzi there. And then we went to dinner, and it was just incredible. There was people leaning over the banquette trying to touch Monica's hair, and it was just incredible. And I was just sitting, getting to know this really lovely girl. I obviously
incredible, like weird, super weird.
Super weird stuff going on, like leaving the restaurant. And I spoke to her recently about this. And she said, I just don't remember that. And she goes, I've blocked out so much. You know, and I understand that from being, you know, having had repressed memories with my dad. Leaving the restaurant with her, it was like a mob scene. And I immediately felt so protective of her. And I really feel it came from, we hit it off. We had nice chats. And then I helped her get home. And I just was like, wow, she's got, and then I read the book that, what's his name wrote, the man who wrote the Diana book as well, you know that one.
Andrew Morton?
Yes, I read that book, and I was just, I'd obviously known what the sort of headlines were and watched things on television, but hearing it from her point of view, I was like, what the hell? And so then we just stayed friends. And I went, you know, it went through various stages of when she, the first couple of years we were friends, she kind of would come out to things, and then she kind of hid away. Then she went to London and did her course in psychology, and then she kind of hid and kept her head down and tried to figure out what to do with her life. And she knew that, you know, she was on a hiding to nothing. Whatever she did, it was always going to come back to that. And if she tried to do anything with her life, then it was like, oh, she was using all that as a stepping stone, and it was just a mess. And then I think she just waited and got better. And also she was going through a lot of stuff herself. She was trying to deal with the fact that she had been shamed and abused,
violated
in this incredible, unlike anyone else in history, actually. And so that's why when I think about her, I think she is a remarkable person to have gone through everything she's gone through and to come out of it so kind and well-balanced. It's a miracle. You know, she is, it shows what an incredible person and the sort of strength of her character and her upbringing and her values. Because she, it's inconceivable to think some of the things I've experienced with her early on, the way people reacted to her. And so for that to be your life every single day, and then to be so wronged in such a public way, and also to see the person who betrayed you, denied you. I mean, I guess it was Linda Tripp who ultimately betrayed her, but for the president to say on television that she was lying, to see him kind of be, for his reputation to be restored and to be like, oh, what a great guy. Very quickly. To have that all happen, I think that must have been a total mind fuck. And that must be, and also to have been in love. That you have been in love. You're young, you're in your early 20s, you're in love. And you get that happens to you. What does that do to how you think about relationships and your possibility of that? You know, I mean, it's just, so to have, for her to have been so eloquent and elegant in the way that she's come back and talked about it, given her blessing to this TV show, to use her platform for other people who are internet shamed and you know, bullied online and everything. It's just, I think she's an incredible person. And also, you know, also hilarious. One of the funniest people I know. And just, and kind and love. And she's, you know, she was at my wedding. She knows my mom, you know, my family all love her. my mum had this friend called Jack, who was a sort of partner, and he died sadly, but he once said, and Monica loves this, he said, you know, you should tell of all the famous people I've met with you, Alan, not Tina Turner, it's Monica who's my favourite one, like that. I love Tina Turner gets pushed to the curb.
Well, I just, you know, I would, you know, you can only imagine the trauma that she went through.
And also, I think, you know, this TV show that's on right now, the impeachment, and it's very interesting because it tells it from the point of view of the woman. It's mostly about, you know, obviously Monica's a big, huge character in it, but it's mostly about Linda Tripp. I think what's really interesting, you see how all these women are manipulated into behaving the way they did and tricked and, you know, and it's so sad.
What? Nothing. What's wrong? Is he not able to bring you back?
It's not happening.
Oh, Monica. To wait this long and he doesn't have the power to bring you back.
He does have the power.
Well, then what's the problem?
Linda, he's the president. We had an affair. It's over.
I think right now it's a very triggering time for Monica.
Yes, of course.
Reliving the most traumatic time of her life and having the rest of the world see it. And being worrying the last time they saw it, they judged her in a very different way. I think she's having a tough time right now, just because of all that. But I keep saying to her, you must understand that it is such a positive thing for you. The way that everyone is so sort of both ashamed at how they bought into the whole thing 20 years ago, and also so proud of you for coming back and dealing with that and doing it face on and making sure that other people benefit from the retelling of what happened to you. It's amazing.
She's in the process of reclaiming her narrative, but she's coming out the other side, right?
Yeah, she is.
And that's an uncomfortable place.
But it is difficult. It's so difficult.
We'll be right back. Do you find writing, obviously you like to write, it's fun for you. Have you always sort of been drawn to the written word that way? And or is this kind of something that happened later in life?
Well, I used to write, I started off, I did a stand-up thing with a friend at college and we wrote all our own material and we wrote sort of loads of stuff, actually. We went from being sort of like, you know, drunk students making things up at college into sort of national treasures in Scotland, and we had our own TV shows and everything, and we wrote all that. And then I wrote more performative things. I wrote a sitcom in Britain and stuff like that. And then you know, it's, so in terms of the writing I do now, which is much more booky, I wrote a novel that came out in 2002, and I think I want to get back to that. Actually, I think the next thing I actually really enjoyed finishing off this book during the pandemic. I'd been working on it for a few years, but getting the chance to actually really sit down and do it every day and think about it and work out what, you know.
And yeah, not that, have too many distractions, right?
Exactly. Not fit it into 15 other things in a day. So I sort of think now I'd like to go try and, you know, if I do a book, if I write a next book, I think I'd like it to be a novel, and I think I'd like to try and really take the time off to do it and not just try and fit it into between films, although next year's looking a bit busy.
Which is good, yes, good.
Yes, it's good, but it's also, I'm doing a thing that's completely nuts, which just takes me out for like 4 months next year. I'm going to do a solo dance piece it starts off at the Edinburgh Festival and then, you know, it's a tour and then comes to the Joyce Theatre in New York. And I love it because it's sort of the fact, my stage, you know, cabaret show I'm doing right now, one of them is called Alan Cumming Is Not Acting His Age. And that's totally what I'm doing in this thing. But I love the fact that I'll be 57 and I'll be doing a dance piece. I'm not a dancer, but I'm allowed to, I'm working with great people. I'm going to give it my best shot. I think that thing of sometimes, you know, daring yourself to, challenging yourself to do something that you might fail at is actually, for me, a really important part of how I live. I every now and every few years, I see a pattern. I do something like that.
That scares you.
Scares me like up the wazoo. Like even like, right, you know, physically, I might not be able to do this. I'm nearly 60 and that I'm going to do a dance piece, a solo dance piece. It's not even other people around that I can sort of, you know, they can do a bit whilst I catch my breath. We're going to have video and things as well. But anyway, that I think is really exciting. I'm really excited by that. But it takes me away for many months. And I'm missing the idea of being in my place in the Catskills and, you know, just going downstairs in my pajamas and writing.
It would be great. Have you ever thought, you know, as I've read more memoirs, I've thought about like Billy Crystal's one-man show that he did, kind of tracing his life on Broadway.
Was that
about
the Sundays, something Sundays? Yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes. That was great. Yeah.
And it seems to me, Alan, your life would really lend itself to something like that. Would that ever interest you?
Well, I mean, I sort of feel that's what my cabaret shows are like. The one, like I do these shows. I mean, I sing songs, I tell stories, and they've got a theme. Like the last one was called Legal Immigrant. It was about me being, you know, becoming a citizen of America. This one's called Alan Cumming's Not Acting His Age. That's about aging and stuff. And the one before that was called Alan Cumming Sings Sappy Songs. And I talked a bit about my dad and stuff and that. So I kind of think I do that. And I really like that. Oops. I really like that sort of connection you get with an audience when it's you, not a character. You know, it's really you talking. And I sing as myself and I sing in my own Scottish accent as well. And I really enjoy that. But I don't know. After Not My Father's Son came out, people said, okay, my agents at the time were like, okay, what about the film rights? I was like, what do you mean? Because we're not going to sell the film rights of my traumatic childhood. I think writing the book's fine. I think, you know, choose your medium.
Well, I love talking to you and I could just talk to you all day because
it's lovely to talk to
first
you,
of all, I love your accent and I love what you're saying. But your new book is called Baggage. I think people are going to love it and they already love you. Well, most people. You
can't. Right, yeah.
You listen, Alan, you can't bat 1,000. I mean, we live in this crazy world and
totally.
I think.
And I don't like everybody. I don't expect everyone to like me. I expect everyone to respect me though.
Yeah, I saw that on Instagram. Why should everyone like you when you don't like everyone?
Yeah, fair enough.
You know?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, like, let's not shit on people.
Right.
You may not like people, but you don't have to be so aggressive.
It's
about
like
it,
RPG,
right?
Is like, you know, I'm not asking for just whatever, but just take your boot off my neck.
Yeah.
I love that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Anyway, thank you, Alan.
So lovely. Good luck with your
Great
book, too.
Great to see you. Thank you. Good luck with yours, but not as much luck as mine.
Bless you for that magnanimous finish.
I just love him, don't you? By the way, Alan Cumming's memoir, his second, is called Baggage, Tales from a Fully Packed Life. Nice title, right? Go check it out, everyone. Next Question with Katie Couric is a production of iHeartMedia and Katie Couric Media. The executive producers are me, Katie Couric, and Courtney Litz. The supervising producer is Lauren Hansen. Associate producers, Derek Clements, Adriana Fazio, and Emily Pinto. The show is edited and mixed by Derek Clements. For more information about today's episode or to sign up for my morning newsletter, Wake Up Call, go to katiecouric.com. You can also find me at Katie Couric on Instagram and all my social media channels. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.